Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by physician, educator, and public health leader, Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about the development of smart skin technology. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Margaret Flinter.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on a partnership between nursing students and children in an effort to combat childhood obesity in Hispanic youth. While obesity rates for all children in the U.S. have risen sharply over the past few decades, it's especially alarming in minority populations and particularly among Hispanic children. The University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio is leading the program. Faculty there have begun a training curriculum for nursing students, which focuses on education about the lifelong effects of obesity, how to prevent it, and how to reverse it through healthy choices in diet and exercise. Nursing students are understanding how culture affects health risk behaviors in Hispanic children and in adolescents in low-income and urban settings. Since the Movete USA program began this spring, Hispanic nursing students in Chicago, Phoenix, San Antonio, and in Brownsville, Texas are learning how to become trained influencers in their own communities. And with nurses from the National Association of Hispanic Nurses on board and funding from private foundations, more Hispanic nursing students will likely join the ranks. A program that recognizes the pivotal role that Hispanic nurses can play in fighting childhood obesity in their communities, now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, a physician, educator, and public health leader whose career has spanned more than 40 years. He's currently the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy and a professor of pediatrics at George Washington University and a practicing physician at the Upper Cardozo Community Health Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Dr. Mullen.
Glad to be here.
Your career has spanned 40 tumultuous years in healthcare, and your book, White Coat, Clenched Fist, was described as a memoir, but you wrote it in 1976, still early in your career, about the injustices in the healthcare system. Along with many others, you've made the elimination of those injustices, which lead to profound health disparities based on race and income and insurance, a cornerstone of your work. From your perspective today, what has been accomplished and what do you see as the key battles still to be won?
Well, I'd start by saying I do think we've made progress. I have friends and even myself on bad days sort of say, gee, we've been at this for 40 years, or at least I have, and things you could argue are not so hot. Things are, I think, a good deal better in terms of equity than they were 40 years ago. I say that without any sense of a braggadocio, but to look at the evidence that suggests we're doing better. I think the huge racial gap in the country is hard at this point in time to appreciate. I mean, the gap that existed, the systematized segregation that took place in the South and the semi-systematized that took place in the North. And you have improved statistics in a variety of ways, improved health outcomes among African Americans in particular, which, despite the gap that still remains, represent major steps forward and something of a closing of the gap. I think you have, in terms of health career opportunities, a fairly serious, fairly coast-to-coast effort to improve opportunities for disadvantaged and unrepresented minority students, which was not the circumstance. I went to medical school, graduated in 68. We had one non-white student, and he came from Nigeria. And I think during the 4 years I was at school, we had one African-American in the school. And this was a sort of standard northern school. So we've come a long way in that regard.
Well, much of your work and writing has certainly focused on the whole issue of training and education of healthcare professionals, and particularly primary care providers. And you've written about the impact of graduate medical education caps, about the role of non-physician providers in primary care, and also the need to reform medical education generally to prepare for the demands of the 21st century. So certainly a major focus of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is the healthcare workforce. We'd be interested in your thoughts on whether that bill went far enough to address the issues of looming primary care provider shortages, and whether you think the remedies prescribed, expanding the National Health Service Corps, which you were once the director of, loans and scholarships, community-based residencies, are the right ones to address the problems, or did you have recommendations that did not find their way into the legislation?
Well, I, like many other people, dreamed of a single bill. We used to call it national health insurance back in the 70s, maybe, and health care reform in the 90s, and the Affordable Care Act today, one bill that would remake the system. And I think we certainly learned in the 90s with health care reform, if we didn't know, that the system is so large and so complicated and so nuanced that no one bill, no matter how wise and how politically and clinically accurate, one couldn't conceive of a bill that would fix the whole system in one shot. And so what we got in the in 2010 has been a bill which has many pieces of reform and many pieces of many islands of new health equity and new health opportunity, which are indeed islands that have water still between them that needs to be dredged or filled in. In regard to workforce, I think we got some very appreciable new tools. The increase in the size of the National Health Service Corps, coupled with the increase in the size of the funds available for community health centers, really will provide a much stronger and much less porous safety net, I think, a few years out. The incentives for primary care, I actually think the toughest long-term issue for the country is the whole issue of generalist care. And this isn't just in shortage areas, it's across the country, because, of course, we're bankrupting ourselves with the system we have now, which is way too specially dependent and way too fragmented. It's not only inefficient, it's not only not user-friendly, but it's also enormously, egregiously expensive. And developing both a workforce as well as a patient population that will appreciate the importance of generalist care, which we call primary care, but it's the generalist approach, is a real challenge, because the incentives have all been laid the other way. So on making those incentives and rebuilding ones that will make primary care as attractive a career as specialty care and make populations understand the importance of having good generalist care for prevention, for education, for dealing with 90% of what ails all of us all of the time, getting that message through is a really tough one, particularly when you're running up against all kinds of commercial and heavy-duty advertising campaigns that push people in the other way. So I think we built some good blocks. I think we have a lot to work with, but we're not there yet.
Dr. Millen, I want to get back to that, your fellow student from Nigeria, because you've been equally concerned with workforce issues abroad. And while foreign-trained doctors make up an important part of our healthcare workforce, the issues of equity in other countries, especially poor countries, are aggravated when we deprive these countries of trained doctors. And as we try to find ways to expand and diversify our healthcare workforce now that millions more will have insurance under the Affordability Act when the exchanges roll out, will this only get worse? And what are the alternatives that you are contemplating?
Well, we've developed an enormous dependence on international or foreign-trained health workers, not only in medicine, but in nursing and pharmacy, home health care. Why have we done that? Are we insufficiently wealthy to provide training? I don't think so. Are we insufficiently able to recruit people of skill and ambition from the population in the country? I don't think so. We've done it because it's been cheap and easy, and it's conformed to the needs of institutions who want quick labor, of other institutions who have not, training institutions who have not been able to obtain or haven't sought the additional funding they need to build themselves fully out or start new institutions. And finally, of course, the foreign workers are eager to get into this country and are happy to take the jobs that U.S. physicians, nurses, and pharmacists and others aren't keen to have. So it's a very complex and integrally functioning nexus that have brought us to where we are. What we need to do is wean ourselves from our dependence on foreign labor for two reasons. One, it's not good for us, and secondly, it's not good for the countries who are paying to train folks only to have them siphoned off after the investments been made in them to the industrial world, ourselves in particular. It's what I call reverse foreign aid. I mean, we're busy giving out foreign aid on the one hand, and particularly in health and medical education, and then on the other hand, we're setting up a market situation that sucks that labor right into our country. Not good for the country, either country involved. It's a big challenge, as I say, because the forces at play are quite comfortable with the current system. But it is, in the long term, I think, ultimately not a moral system, and it's not an effective system. The answer to it is being much more attentive to the educational requirements that it will take to build a workforce of the size and type that we need, and that means long-term educational funding and investment, which we at the federal, state, local, and personal level have been remiss to do.
Dr. Mullen, I think of you as one of the individuals who brought the concept of community-oriented primary care into the mainstream of healthcare, a focus on the needs of a community, on a defined population of patients, and responding to the needs of that population based on data and based on the wishes of that community. And as we struggle with the obesity epidemic, I'm always reminded of how important that is. That approach requires both a strong public health system as well as a strong personal health care system. So I'd ask you, would you modify or redefine the concept of community-oriented primary care for today's health care needs?
I recently reviewed a volume that Jaime and Rosa Gofin, G-O-F-I-N, have published on community-oriented primary care and community-oriented public health. They're expanding the concept. I thought it was an interesting expansion. My own belief, and maybe I'm old school, is that the basic principles of COPC, community-oriented primary care, are valuable, viable, and way underused. And the essence of it is using public health precepts in the pursuit of clinical practice. Most of us work one-on-one, not only in our use of time. We're seeing patients one-on-one, but we also think one-on-one and have little reference to what the larger picture is in our community or in our region or in our state, and what the larger numbers tell us about the likelihood of a given condition being prevalent in our population. COPC invites the practitioner to be cognizant of the bigger picture and spend his or her energies not just clinically, but in the efforts of the practice or of the enterprise that the doctor as a whole or the clinic as a whole undertakes. Community interventions, specific campaigns against certain, whether it's teen pregnancy or whether it's community violence or any one of the numbers of things that plague our communities. The ability to know the bigger picture, even as you pursue direct patient care, will make you and your practice more efficient. That's COPC, and I think it has a great deal to offer in all aspects of our system.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, professor of health policy and pediatrics at George Washington University. Dr. Mullen, you've written numerous books and articles on medical and health policy topics. You were the original editor of a popular column, Narrative Matters in Health Affairs, which features first-person narratives and stories that illuminate often complex health policy issues. And you still serve as a contributing editor, but can you tell us what that type of contribution, that type of writing adds to healthcare? Is there evidence to suggest that it makes doctors or healthcare providers better practitioners?
Certainly, there's been a robust response to the column in terms of people writing, mm-hmm. wanting to tell their stories, clinicians and others. Mm-hmm. Additionally, there's been numbers of reader surveys and others of health affairs, and it's always rated very high. Many say they read it first, mm-hmm. On the premise that the premise we started it on, that it's often easier to get a policy message packaged in a
storytelling
in a story than it is, say, in a table or a statistical approach. Both obviously have their role. We're not against formalized evidence, but the human tradition of telling stories has been around since man started, and will be around, I dare say, as long as we are. So we simply tried to bend that to the use of health policy, and I think by and large it's been very well received, and many people have clarified and codified their own experiences as clinicians and patients by writing about it.
I'll admit to being one of those people who read Narrative Matters first. So, Dr. Mullen, let me, if I can, return to that book that you wrote, White Coat, Clenched Fist, for a moment. It's a title that captures the anger and the activism of a generation of young students of the health professions. And I read a review of that book from somebody who wrote about the vulnerability of the ill, even for doctors when they're sick, saying that there are rarely clenched fists in a hospital bed. I think that's a pretty good metaphor for new doctors and nurses in today's healthcare system, where the stress and the demands are overwhelming and maybe not so conducive to activism. From your perspective, do you see that call to action and activism in the students you work with today that many of us felt early in our careers?
Well, that's a good question, Margaret. I get asked that from time to time. It's pretty hard to be scientific about that. It's kind of a sense of one's own experience at the time, then or now. Certainly the 60s were a time when students across the board were very active in the sense of protesting or objecting to or trying to change their society. And it was relatively easy to be an activist because there were activists everywhere. In the quieter periods, say the 80s, that was less the case. I mean, to be outspoken was harder in the sense that there was less built-in approbation of others doing it or others being recognized for doing it. So I think it waxes and wanes a little bit in terms of the tenor of the country as a whole. What I will say is I think that the idealism resident in health profession students is always catches me by surprise. I mean, when you can sit back and think about, well, they weren't as active as they were, or they ought to be, or whatever. And then you sit with a group of students who are concerned about an issue and are willing to put in their nights and their weekends or their summers to do something about it. It is always energizing for me. And that reservoir is there. I think today, interestingly, the enormous outpouring of interest in global health, and particularly in Africa, is a manifestation of that. I've often wondered, is it out of frustration with our own country, that the sense of motion, or put it differently, the sense of frustration for those trying to change and improve the system has been so battered or beaten about that the opportunities to make a difference abroad have an appeal that they mightn't if things were moving better or quicker here. If indeed the current legislation begins to move and change the system, will the opportunities for students to become more active, not just in protesting, but in terms of staffing, working with and helping to improve the system, will they return home? Will we repatriate them? I think it'll be interesting to see. But I think students are a constant reservoir of change, and above and beyond what they do as individuals, what they do as a group is terribly important for where we go as a medical community, a clinical community, and as a nation.
Speaking about where we go and Africa and points beyond, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
We are in an effort of burgeoning once again, or developing new health institutions, health professions institutions, particularly in medicine. After 25 years with no new medical schools, there are now some 12 allopathic schools and roughly an equal number of osteopathic schools that have either come online recently or are coming online very shortly. A number of these have fairly innovative and new models in terms of their educational mission. I like to think of them in terms of Flexner and post-Flexner, with Flexner being the 100th anniversary of the Flexner Report. Mm-hmm. Flexner, for all the success he had and brought to us in terms of quality, regularizing, standardizing medical education, which was all over the lot before him, it also highly specified, limited, and arguably rigidified it, so that many students who were not first-rate test takers and scientists were denied admission. Many African Americans and women found it more difficult to get into schools, and schools tended to produce a very uniform product. I think we're seeing innovations that are looking beyond that, and places like the A.T. Still School in Flagstaff, Arizona, an osteopathic school, which is using community health centers as the basic teaching platform for the latter 3 years of medical school. We're looking at schools that have curricula that are very much in touch with social accountability. What is the school? What is the class? What is the student doing to be accountable to the society that is in need and often responsible for the sponsorship of the school or the student? So it's these kind of innovations in education which I think are promising and hopefully will be the way of the future.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, the Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy and Professor of Pediatrics at George Washington University, and a practicing physician at the Upper Cardozo Community Health Center in Washington, D.C. Fitzhugh, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Developers are calling it smart skin. Picture a press-on tattoo. But in place of the classic heart and Cupid's arrow, tiny electronic sensors thinner than the diameter of a human hair would be embedded on polyester backing and stuck onto a patient's skin. The journal Science reported that in tests, the device remained in place for up to 24 hours. Although normal shedding of skin cells would eventually cause the monitors to come off, they have the potential to remain in place for as long as 2 weeks. The bandage-like device relies on a weak energy called the van der Waals force to adhere to the skin. This causes molecules and surfaces to stick together without interfering with motion. The immediate interest for such an innovation is to measure a patient's vital signs in a more reliable, more convenient, and less stressful way. The smart skin bandage would take the place of the bulky wiring and electrodes that are normally used to monitor vital signs. But down the road, developers say the device could be used to track brain waves, aid muscle movement, and even emit heat to help heal wounds.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.